Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 220. It's Monday, July 17th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, I want to start off with an interesting fresh perspective story, although it actually goes back a long time, as reality remains quite persistent. This is a story about hunger and how it's produced by violence in the world. And actually, world hunger was a concern that got me involved in social justice early in my life. And the one thing I learned is that hunger is human-made, way, way, way more so than by nature. This, from nature. Hunger and famine are not accidents. They are created by the actions of people. Hundreds of millions of people are going hungry as conflicts affect food supplies. There's also growing evidence that food producers are exploiting the situation to increase their profits. Around 200 million people are experiencing acute food insecurity. They include some in Afghanistan, Burkina Faso, Ethiopia, Mali, Sudan, and Syria, countries that have something else in common. Each is experiencing a deadly conflict. These two situations, hunger and conflict, are connected. In a report presented to the United Nations in March, the organization's special rapporteur on the right to food, Michael Fakhry, said that violence and conflict are in fact the primary causes of hunger worldwide. They are also pivotal reasons that the world is not on track to end hunger and malnutrition by 2030, a promise made by world leaders at a UN summit in 2015 as part of the Sustainable Development Goals. This is alarming for a number of reasons. For one thing, it suggests that unless something is done, we are abandoning hundreds of millions of people to severe hunger. Furthermore, crucial efforts to study and implement policies to end hunger are hampered when violence breaks out. In September, heads of government will meet in New York City to work out what can be done. Although that meeting takes place at a time of great tension between world powers, attendees must accept that the Sustainable Development Goals to end hunger will not be met unless violence is reduced, or at the very least, unless parties to conflict stop weaponizing food. Fakhry's report draws on decades of studies as well as newer data from bodies including the UN's World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN. The report describes the relationship between violence in various forms, including sexual and gender-based violence and food insecurity. Conflicts endanger food security when, for example, crops are destroyed or food supplies are disrupted, things that have happened and continue to happen in wars from Mali to Myanmar. Coercive measures such as international economic sanctions against warring countries also contributes to hunger. The evidence, according to the report, is that targeted sanctions disrupt food systems as well. The UN Special Rapporteur's report also brings home how global economic events are exacerbating hunger and food insecurity. Food prices have rocketed in most places, especially in low and middle-income countries. In the rich countries that are members of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, food price inflation dropped to around 12% on average in April, but it remains much higher in a number of low and middle-income countries. 81% inflation in Lebanon, 27% in Egypt, and 31% in Zimbabwe, according to the World Bank data published last month. That is down to factors such as the COVID-19 pandemic and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The war affected the global supply of staple crops, Before the invasion, Russia and Ukraine together grew one-third of the world's wheat. The global spike in energy prices is also affecting the ability of the poorest families to use gas and other fuels for cooking. But researchers are reporting that food inflation is also partly caused by producers, especially large firms, putting up prices to increase their profits. Sellers can do this if they know that a buyer has no choice but to pay more to obtain things they cannot do without, such as food and fuel, a phenomenon that researchers call seller's inflation. That might be one reason that inflation remains stubbornly high, especially when it comes to food, and that interventions such as raising interest rates have failed to reduce it. This is the conclusion of two working papers by Isabella Weber, an economist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. In a modeling study published last November, Weber and her co-authors found that the prices of food and energy are the two largest drivers of inflation. In a subsequent study in February, the authors sampled a group of U.S. companies in these sectors and discovered that in 2022, profits were responsible for as much inflation as wages. So we hear that all the time about, oh, you got to, you know, get more unemployment and lower wages because that's had inflation. But actually, the as big or bigger is actually just taking profits because you can. Weber's work is sparking change among some governments and getting attention from financial institutions. The International Monetary Fund found last month that corporate profits accounted for nearly half of inflation in the euro area last year. Weber is among those advocating that governments put a ceiling on some of the prices that producers can charge. However, many academic economists and the governments they advise disagree, saying that such price controls distort markets. The poorest people are caught in the middle of this argument, experiencing harm as a result of both high prices and policy delays. It's important for researchers to continue to uncover evidence about what is exacerbating hunger and how it can be eliminated. More could, for example, study how conflicts affect hunger on a more granular level. They could analyze the components of inflation not only in Europe and the United States, but in low and middle income countries as well. Economist Amartya Sen demonstrated in his 1981 book Poverty and Famines that hunger and famine are not necessarily the result of food shortages, but created by the actions and choices of people. Leaders could make good on their sustainable development goal pledge that hunger and malnutrition must end, or they could continue to target food in conflicts. Both are choices, as Fakhri says, and are not predetermined outcomes. Yep, we can do better. Okay, well, that story sort of tied together violence and world hunger. This next story is another one that brings together two large issues. That is also hunger and nutrition and health, but also how that connects to climate change. And this is from the American Journal of Public Health, and it asks this essential question. Where was climate change at the White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health? The White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health, held on September 28, 2022, included the release of the Biden administration's National Strategy on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health, a, quote, whole-of-government approach to achieving the administration's stated objective of ending hunger and increasing healthy eating and physical activity by 2030 so that fewer Americans experience diet-related chronic diseases like diabetes, obesity, and hypertension. The national strategy comprises more than 140 actions organized into five pillars: improving food access and affordability, integrating nutrition and health, empowering all consumers to make and have access to healthy choices, supporting physical activity for all, and enhancing nutrition and food security research. Despite the existential threat of climate change to human and planetary health, there's only one reference to climate change and the food system in the entire report, and that reference focuses on the need for research rather than actionable strategies and policies that can be implemented today. The link between climate change and the food system is undeniable. By some estimates, food system activities, including food production, distribution, and disposal, produce a third of global greenhouse gas emissions caused by humans. As a driver of climate change, the food system contributes to numerous public health threats, including severe weather events, heat-related illness and death, pollution and poor air quality, vector-borne diseases, and water-related illnesses. At the same time, climate change threatens our ability to provide safe, good quality food for all. The food system is vulnerable to the short and long-term effects of climate change, such as severe weather events that cause disruption to food supply chains. Such disruptions also threaten access to safe drinking water, contributing to water insecurity, which is closely associated with food insecurity. Climate change contributes to undernutrition and diet-related diseases as well. For instance, increased greenhouse gas emissions reduce crop yields and the micronutrient content of crops, both of which contribute to food nutrition insecurity and undernutrition. The disparate effects of diet-related chronic disease, food and nutrition insecurity, and adverse climate events suggest an immediate urgency to promote both sustainable and equitable food and nutrition policies. So this is an essential connection. We want a whole-of-government approach, but of course we need to get all the major policy initiatives integrated to one another. Okay, well next up, some good news, a big leap forward on lead. This from Associated Press. EPA moves to reduce childhood exposure to lead-based paint dust. The Biden administration last Wednesday moved to reduce children's exposure to lead, proposing stricter limits on dust from lead-based paint in older homes and child care facilities. Declaring that there is no safe level of lead, the administration estimates that the proposed rule would reduce lead exposure for approximately 250,000 to 500,000 children under the age of 6 each year. That's important because health scientists have said that for some time that there is no safe level of lead in a child's blood. Lead damages the brain. Lead's damage to the brain is well known. It takes points off IQ, deprives kids of problem-solving abilities, and can make it harder to learn to read. But it also affects other organs, including the liver and kidneys. This proposal to safely remove lead paint, along with other efforts to deliver clean drinking water and replace lead pipes, will go a long way towards protecting the health of our next generation of leaders, Janet McCabe, deputy director of the EPA, said in New Jersey, where the proposal was announced. Paint that contains lead was banned in 1978, but because paint is applied in layers and then chips off or is sanded off during remodeling, more than 30 million American homes are believed to still contain it. The proposed rule targets levels of lead dust. Currently, 10 micrograms per square foot is considered hazardous on floors, and a concentration 10 times that high is considered hazardous on windowsills. The new rule brings both of those down to no detectable lead. Apart from what constitutes a hazard, the proposed rule would reduce what's allowed when a lead contractor, often called a lead abatement contractor, finishes work on a property where lead has been a problem. These levels would be 3 micrograms per square foot on the floor and 20 micrograms per square foot for sills. Public health experts celebrated the announcement, calling the proposed rule long overdue. Dr. Philip Landegren noted that the government has gradually been reducing the standard for what counts as poisonous levels of lead in the blood of children, with the most recent change occurring 2 years ago. But the EPA announcement marks an effort to take more preventive action, he said. When you're relying on the blood lead level in children to indicate whether there is lead in the environment, we are basically using the children as canaries in the mine, said Landergan, a Boston College biology professor who directs the school's program for global public health and the common good. This way, we actually are dealing with the source as opposed to the consequences of exposure, he said. But Cindy Lenhoff, director of the National Child Care Association, worried that the rule change could hurt child care centers that are already struggling financially, especially those in low-income neighborhoods where the facilities tend to be older. No doubt they would be the ones most affected by this change, Lenhoff said in an email. I certainly hope our U.S. legislators realize that the rule needs to be backed up with money to make it happen. Amen to that. David Rosner, a public health historian at Columbia University and expert on the history of lead regulation in the United States, expressed surprise at the EPA announcement, given that new environmental regulations have become more difficult and controversial in recent years. It's nice that they are trying to move at least on this one, obvious long-term problem that we've had for a century, Rosner said. He applauded the rule as overdue recognition that no level of lead exposure is safe for children. Bruce Lamp here, a lead poisoning expert at Canada's Simon Fraser University, said the current standard was based on what was thought to be feasible rather than on science, and this corrects that. But Rasner also noted it's currently just a proposal and will likely face opposition from landlords and others who will likely lament the cost of more aggressive cleanups. It will be interesting to see what politics play out, Rosner said. Okay, well next up we're going to move to another pollution problem, this from DW. Electric vehicle tires, a lesser-known pollution headache. As EV sales have soared, the tire industry has innovated its products to fit the needs of the relatively heavy, efficient, and silent cars. But there is one problem the industry is struggling to crack. As a car's only point of contact with the road, tires do more work than they get credit for. Tires need to grip the road firmly enough for cars to accelerate, turn, and brake without skidding, but they also need to reduce rolling resistance enough to maintain fuel efficiency. For tire manufacturers, creating the perfect tire, one that balances performance and durability, is an unending task. In recent years, the work has been further complicated by electric vehicles. Due to their bigger batteries, electric vehicles tend to be significantly heavier than their internal combustion engine counterparts. Volkswagen e-Golf, for example, is about 400 kilograms heavier than the gas-powered Golf 7. That added weight rests on the car's tires, so EV tires need to be sturdier. EVs also tend to have more torque than combustion engines, which their tires need to be able to transfer to the roads within seconds. How tires cause pollution. Considering the environmental impacts of cars, the focus tends to be on air pollution in the form of exhaust coming out of tailpipes, but tires contribute significantly. Tires wear down over time. With every revolution, they shred teeny particles. The smallest of these pieces go into the air where they can be inhaled or drift off the road to settle on the soil nearby. Tire use is probably the naughtiest problem for vehicles. Nick Molden, founder and CEO of Emission Analytics, told DW, "With a lot of other pollution, you can effectively trap it using some sort of filter or catalyst, but the tire is fundamentally an open system. You cannot encase a tire." Emissions Analytics performs independent tests on cars, including real-world tailpipe and tire emissions. It has compiled data that confirms that tire particulate pollution has significantly surpassed tailpipe emissions. Now, I want to stop here and say this is particulate matter. This isn't talking about the gases like CO2. You can produce tons of that in a car. But when you're talking about the actual particles that are thrown off from exhaust, you get actually more from tires and actually brakes, which would be part of the bonus story. According to a report shared by Emissions Analytics, a single car sheds 4 kilograms, about 8.8 pounds of tire particles per year on average. Multiplied across the global fleet, that equates to 6 million tons of tire particles annually. We measure the amount of solid material that comes out of the tailpipe on the road, and we do the same measuring the mass that's shed by the tires. Every year, the amount coming from tailpipes gets lower and lower, and the amount coming from tires is growing because vehicles are getting heavier. Tire particulate pollution has two primary negative impacts on environmental health. The particulate itself washes into waterways and has been found to be a significant source of oceanic microplastics. Also, tires contain volatile organic compounds, which are hazardous to human health and react in the atmosphere to create smog. A particularly concerning chemical in tires is 6-PPD, which is used to prevent the rubber from cracking and breaking down. 6-PPD is also water-soluble, so it is carried off roads by rain and washed into rivers and oceans, where it has been linked to mass salmon and trout die-offs. Further studies found that 6-PPD is absorbed by edible plants like lettuce and that the compound can be found in human urine. It's the tire industry's mission to secure a safe, comfortable journey with peace of mind, and thus the addition of 6-PPD to tire rubber is currently indispensable. Tire maker Bridgestone told DW. Can tires pollution problem be solved? Phasing out fossil fuel-powered vehicles is an urgently needed aspect of mitigating climate change. But if doing so comes with worsening tire emissions, this is also problematic. The obvious solution is to be driving and selling fewer cars, climate activist Tadzadio Mueller told DW. He added, the shift towards electric vehicles meant to convince us that it's going to save the planet. But of course it cannot, because the problem has always been capitalist growth. Asked if reducing car use overall is the best solution to tires' environmental impacts, Molden told DW, yes, that would reduce tire emissions, but in terms of the lost economic activity, would that be worth it? It's better to create a market mechanism where it's in the interest of tire companies to invest a lot and come up with the best formulations, Molden said, adding that currently there is 2 to 3 times difference between certain tires in terms of volatile organic compound toxicity. Molden said, generally, Europe's leading tire brands are among the best, whereas cheap imports tend to be the worst. So you get what you pay for. On an individual level, avoiding rapid accelerations and immediate stops can reduce tire wear. It's also advisable to use tires to the end of their lifespan, partly because new tires shed twice as much particulate during their first couple thousand kilometers. And whether it's an EV or a combustion engine, vehicles are actually getting heavier, so that only exacerbates the tire problem. Okay, well, next up, some good news. This is from Stat News. FDA approves first over-the-counter birth control pill. In a highly anticipated move, the Food and Drug Administration last Thursday approved the first over-the-counter birth control pill, a decision that could transform the way contraception is delivered in the United States. For the first time, people will now be able to readily purchase birth control online and at pharmacies, convenience stores, and grocery stores without a prescription, a requirement that has been seen as a hurdle to greater access to contraception. Called the O-pill, it is expected to become available in the first quarter of 2024. But the pricing has not yet been disclosed by Perrigo, the company that manufactures the pill. The FDA endorsement comes amid growing support for an over-the-counter birth control pill to lower the high rate of unintended pregnancies, which have been linked to a reduced likelihood of receiving early prenatal care and an increased risk of preterm delivery, also related to abortion rates. In announcing its decision, the agency noted that almost half of the 6.1 million pregnancies in the U.S. each year are unintended. Many patients are unable to get timely appointments for birth control prescriptions, according to physicians. One-third of women who use oral contraceptives missed a dose because they could not obtain it in time, according to a survey conducted last year by Kaiser Family Foundation. The pill contains only progestin, which makes it a safer option compared with combination pills that contain both progestin and estrogen. Women with more medical conditions would be precluded from taking combination pills, which can cause depression, among other things. But progestin-only pills have downsides, including somewhat reduced effectiveness if they are not taken at the same time daily. And in a social side effect, next up from Axios, costs could limit demand for over-the-counter birth control pills. While the FDA decision to approve over-the-counter birth control pills could make contraception more accessible in places where it's hard to find a prescriber, the still unknown cost could be a major hurdle. Why it matters. Health insurance plans are not required to cover birth control methods obtained without a prescription, meaning that consumers who take the O-pill once it's available over-the-counter next year will likely pay out of pocket. The over-the-counter status eliminates a health plan's ability to negotiate prices with the pharmacy, making coverage a less attractive proposition. Consumer product giant Perrigo, which owns the pharma company that produces it, is absolutely under a lot of pressure to ensure that O-pill is affordable, said Sarah McBain, professor of clinical pharmacy practice at the University of California, Irvine. The company wasn't ready to disclose a price and will vie with both prescription birth control pills that are usually covered by health plans and retail for between $20 and $50, along with alternatives like condoms, which usually cost less than $1 each. I'm frankly hoping it's going to be somewhere around the $20 price point, because I think that's going to probably be the sweet spot of being appealing to people who are interested, McBain told Axios. Perrigo is likely focused on uninsured and underinsured people, as well as individuals who not want to go through the process of getting a prescription. In those scenarios, you're not talking about folks who have a lot of extra income lying around to purchase these products, which will also drive the over-the-counter price down. Currently, at least 12 states and the District of Columbia require insurers to cover all over-the-counter contraceptive methods, and how people get reimbursed may vary. Yet another variance between the states. If a state allows a pharmacist to prescribe hormonal birth control, a Medicaid beneficiary could potentially go to a pharmacist and ask that O-pill be prescribed to guarantee coverage, said Lori Sobel, a Kaiser Family Foundation Associate Director of Women's Health Policy. Another way, Sobel said, is to have the state place a standing order for a prescription for anyone who walks in. Additionally, states could also choose to use their own funds to cover drugs bought without a prescription. The bottom line, while we won't know until 2024 how O-pills does over-the-counter, health experts expect that the FDA decision will improve overall access and reduce the number of unplanned pregnancies, which is resonating in the post-Roe era. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, next up is another story that also gets to the point that you can have a drug or a program and service doesn't necessarily mean it'll be utilized. Access is important. This from Stat News. Why more Americans aren't using the 988 Mental Health Crisis Hotline? It's been a year since the U.S. launched its 988 National Mental Health Hotline, and while the service is still dealing with logistical challenges, its biggest issue may be persuading more Americans to make use of it. Only 33% of Americans are at least somewhat familiar with the number and the service it provides, according to a survey of more than 2,000 adults conducted by Ipsos and the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, conducted in June 2023. A larger percentage of Americans had at least heard of the 988, 63%, but didn't know much more about it. Still, this was an improvement compared with September 22, when only 44% of Americans had heard about it at all. An overwhelming majority of survey participants, more than 90%, said they have never contacted 988 for a mental health emergency on their own behalf or on the behalf of someone else, and only 22% of all survey respondents said they trust the service, quote, a great deal. By comparison, 43% said they have a great deal of trust in the 911 emergency number. The survey also suggests some people may be hesitant to call 988 because they're concerned about getting the police involved. An average of 60% of respondents said they were afraid that they or a loved one could be hurt by the police intervening in a mental health crisis. This is an even bigger fear among members of marginalized groups, concerning 78% of LGBTQ plus people, 77% of black people, and 75% of Hispanic people, compared to 53% of white people. There's a significant concern among black adults around what a police response would look like and if an individual might be harmed, said Hannah Wesolowski, NAMI's chief advocacy officer. I think that's consistent with what we've seen for the traumatic and tragic outcomes of a police response to a mental health crisis. And we know that typically that has been the only response available in most communities, from crisis to dispatch to call 911 and dispatch police, she said. The 988 Mental Health Crisis Line only deploys a mobile crisis unit in about 2% of cases, says Wesolowski. And even then, the intervention is led by mental health specialists. But potential callers may not be aware of that. A 2016 study estimated 1 in 5 fatal police encounters follow calls about an individual's, quote, disruptive behavior directly due to mental illness or substance abuse. Black people are about half as likely as white people to access mental health treatment. It's been suggested that this discrepancy could be attributed to stigma in many black communities around seeking help for mental health issues. Yet, the NAMI survey's findings challenge this narrative. That's in keeping with the perspective of organizations like the Collaborative for Community Wellness, a Chicago-based coalition of mental health professionals and community-based organizations that work to address the shortage of mental health resources among black and Latino communities. We have found through our research, and just again through the work that we've done locally, the biggest barrier is actually access. It's not actually stigma, said Arturo Carrillo, CCW's Director for Health and Violence Prevention. In fact, he says, in multiple CCW surveys, stigma ranked towards the bottom of reasons that stop people from getting care. The cost of treatment was the biggest challenge, alongside the lack of practitioners working in low-income areas. We see about an average of 4.5 therapists per 1,000 community residents in more affluent white neighborhoods, and in low-income communities of color, the ratio was closer to 0, which is 0.2 therapists per 1,000 residents, said Carrillo. So that's 0.2 compared to 4.5. Yikes. A chasm. The vast majority of mental health specialists are also white, and black people and other people of color may struggle to find care from people who can understand their background, historical trauma, or cultural issues. When we can't provide that care, it becomes much more difficult for someone to see the value and potential impact of accessing that care. Amen. Okay, well, next up is yet another example, this case with a drug that we know often drugs have side effects and might cause patients to discontinue or be wary to even begin treatment. This one's about Wegovy, the new weight loss drug. This is from Reuters. Exclusive. Most patients using weight loss drugs like Wegovy stop within a year, data show. Only about 1/3 of patients prescribe a popular weight loss drug like Wegovy were still taking it a year later, while total healthcare costs for the group rose sharply, according to an analysis of U.S. pharmacy claims shared with Reuters. Patrick Gleason, Prime's Assistant Vice President for Health Outcomes and a co-author of the analysis, said this real-world data suggests a substantial drop in adherence compared to what was reported in clinical trials. The majority of patients aren't getting the value of the product, and there's waste, especially with an expensive therapy, Gleason said. I was a little bit surprised by the persistency rate, or lack thereof. Prime did not ask patients why their prescriptions stopped. Gleason suggested a mix of possibilities, including patients finding the nausea and vomiting side effects too severe or an inability to afford to keep paying co-pays or deductibles. So just another, reminder that the real life experiences of people on drugs can often be very different from what we find in clinical trials. So the drugs may work similarly, but the way that they're used and the regularity or extent that they're used can vary a lot in the real world.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, next up is another gap in health and biomedical research that I've reported on a lot before about male and female differences, and that both drugs and conditions that affect men get more research. So we know more about men than women. This from Axios.com and the underlying biology. How male and female sex chromosomes influence diseases. Scientists are beginning to understand how sex chromosomes and hormones affect people's risk for certain diseases and whether the biology behind those differences can be harnessed to improve treatments. Why it matters? Doctors and scientists have long recognized certain diseases affect men and women differently, but that is rarely reflected in the dosage and design of drugs. Wouldn't you think that by common sense, sex would be the first thing that we would take into account? But we don't. What's driving the news? A newly approved drug for Alzheimer's disease may be less effective for women, who are more likely to develop disease over their lifetime than men. Oh. What's happening? Study after study has described the differences in the impact of disease between males and females. In the U.S., 80% of people who have an autoimmune disease are female. Women are more likely to develop severe COVID, but emerging evidence suggests long COVID is more common among women. Nearly two-thirds of people aged 65 and older in the U.S. with Alzheimer's disease are women. The big picture, for decades, the subjects in basic research experiments and clinical trials have heavily skewed male. Females make up nearly half the planet's population. Why wouldn't you want to understand 50% of the picture? There really was this idea that one should minimize sex-specific differences because they weren't biologically interesting. Gag. The overall reliance on males stemmed in part from long-held assumptions about the impact of hormones on female subjects. That was recently challenged in a study that found that the behavior of male mice was more unpredictable than females. So much for histrionic mice. An act passed in 1993 required studies supported by the National Institutes of Health to include women, and in 2016, the agency adopted a policy requiring females in animal studies and for researchers to account for sex as a biological variable. The issue is we have so much data on males, not females, says Natalie Tronson, professor in the psychology department at the University of Michigan. Males have become the default baseline or normal. That's changing slowly. Where it stands now. An analysis published in 2020 found an increase in studies that included males and females, about 28% in 2009, up to 49% in 2019. But there was no change in the proportion of studies that included data analyzed by sex. The International Committee on Medical Journal Editors in May updated its guidelines to encourage authors to report sex when referring to biological factors and gender when referring to identity, psychosocial, or cultural factors in the study. Of course, some people's sex chromosomes don't align with their gender. The bottom line, the sexes are equal, but very different, and we need to account for those differences. Okay, well, next up, I have two stories I'd like to close out my regular reporting in this episode. And they're both lessons learned articles. This first one from the American Journal of Public Health. East Palestine, Ohio railroad derailment. Lessons to learn, action to take. East Palestine, Ohio is the latest example of the creation of a preventable long-term health hazard for people on the planet. The train derailment at East Palestine was not inevitable. Approximately 1,000 derailments were reported in the United States during 2022 alone. Train accidents are more common in the United States than in comparable countries, despite fewer passenger miles and less freight transported. I would like to point out that I don't like using the word accidents, and I'm very disappointed that the American Journal of Public Health editors did not. I guess the thing is, if you call, derailments or whatever, I guess accident's the best word. But the reason we don't like to use the word accident is because it implies that there is no reason for it or cause. Okay. The risk for train derailment and its consequences should have been avoided by better supervision and regulation by the Department of Transportation and the Environmental Protection Agency, respectively. The key issue in whose interests these governmental bodies are acting, it's easy to assume that their only concern is to keep the public safe. The United States has strong inequities in power, with wealthy individuals and corporations advocating deregulation in their own interests. Government agencies can be portrayed as overbearing and ineffective purveyors of, quote, red tape that stifles innovation, which adds fuel to a bonfire of regulations, potentially leaving the rest of us at risk. Norfolk Southern Railroad was lobbying against, quote, regulatory burdens while advertising that, quote, safety is a way of life and one of our guiding principles. For example, a rule concerning advanced train braking technology was recently removed. Although this regulation may not have prevented the disaster in East Palestine, this type of deregulation indicates the direction of travel regulations. The U.S. train industry has become decreasingly less regulated over the past 40 years. Taken together, regulatory capture and vested interests generate a, quote, doom loop. Regulatory capture results in public agencies acting against the public interest and in the interests of capital gain by heads of industry, which promote distrust and lack of support for the very institutions, such as the EPA, that are intended to promote the public interest. Vested interests siphon wealth to the rich, leaving less money for regulatory control and more risk to be suffered by everyone else, and hence more regulatory failure. More monitoring of wheel bearings, removal of loose wheels, better braking technologies, more safety inspections, more staff, and less precision scheduled railroading, and hence shorter trains, have all been suggested as ways of making the railroad safer. East Palestine was unlucky enough to be where a preventable environmental disaster occurred as a result of the current deregulated system. This event should serve as a wake-up call for us to act together to demand regulatory independence that acts in the public interest. The lives of our loved ones and the planet are at stake. In the context of regulatory capture, the decision to have the controlled burn-off in East Palestine needs to be reviewed, and the EPA appointment of Norfolk Southern Railroad to lead the cleanup rescinded. It is completely inappropriate for Norfolk Southern Railroad to be involved in the cleanup, as they obviously have a vested interest in minimizing their reporting of hazards, as illustrated by concerns about one of their contractors. The EPA has appointed the fox to mind the henhouse. There you go. That's the underlying problem and cause of that accident.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up, I have the second Lessons Learned article, and this is a reflection from your local epidemiologist at Substack, Caitlin Jadalina. Here we go. Lessons I learned during the pandemic. For the past 3.5 years, I've been going 2,000 miles an hour, just trying not to crash into the guardrail. Emergencies will do that, particularly in spaces that aren't prepared. I'm finally able to slow down and process the good and bad in both my roles, being in the front lines and of the response and publishing your local epidemiologist. Lessons I learned. The three most important words, I don't know. Approach threats with humility. Man, this stupid virus gave us some surprises. Approach populations with humility. Helicoptering in is not the same thing as stakeholder engagement. There are many tough and tougher policy decisions during an emergency. Many decisions were leaps of faith. Schools were a great example. Public-private partnerships are crucial. Operation Warp Speed, Google Mobility Data, CVS and Walgreens and vaccine distribution, antigen tests and U.S. Postal Service, contact tracing, wastewater, public health was brought to a new level. Human beings don't like being reminded of their vulnerabilities. It brings out a lot of hate and anger. We can do hard things. 91% of Americans 12 years and older have one COVID-19 vaccine shot. That's absolutely huge. Public health is inherently political. Policy isn't just based on science, but also culture, psychology, politics, and values. A lot of the time we agree on data, but we value different priorities. Using public health as a partisan pawn, though, will cost lives. Using masks, or lack thereof, as a tribal symbol is a prime example. Scientific communication? Oh, where do I begin? This deserves its own post. Things I got wrong. Hindsight is 20/20, but there is a difference between being wrong versus being off because of limited knowledge at the time. There are things I need to be better at in the future, regardless of the rapidly changing evidence. Here are some examples. Noise. I initially dismissed lab spillover theory because of the messenger, Trump, and because it was wrapped up in other conspiracy theories. I'm getting better at dealing with noise, but not perfect. Feasibility. I strongly supported CDC's recommendation of masking under 5 years old, but I ultimately think the WHO got this right. Mask over 5 years old. Families were kicked off flights because toddlers wouldn't wear a mask without crying. I felt for those parents. I was that parent. Feasibility is a big part of public health adherence. Being partisan. I fell for the partisan bait many times. This isn't how we build new foundations of trust. Things I hope you learned. Science is ever evolving. It never stops. A healthy population is a healthy economy. These interests are not competing, but rather complementary. Inequality is so very apparent in health and well-being. It's really easy to forget how bad and scary it was. Revisionism is real and can happen unconsciously. When public health works, it's invisible, but there are a ton of people working their butts off. As the Peace Corps says, it's the toughest job you'll ever love. Public health is a cycle of panic and neglect. We need to stop this. Supporting public health is just words unless it's backed up with funding. The bottom line? The pandemic made us move at incredible speed. We were bound to make mistakes. But as Jonathan Mann said during the HIV era, at the time of plague, we did not flee, we did not hide, and we did not separate. Here's to learning, adapting, and being better prepared for tomorrow. Amen to that. Okay, last up, our regular feature of bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. Have a record-setting 32 bonus articles this week, so put on your seatbelts, particularly if you're in a car. Bonus Article 1. Houston just started enforcing a decade-old ban on feeding the homeless. Food Not Bombs volunteers are fighting back. So this one tugs close to my heart since we have Food Not Bombs here in Toledo. And making it illegal to feed the homeless, not a good idea. We should fight that. Bonus Article 2. New York hotline to advise police on involuntary hospitalizations has gotten zero calls. This is perhaps the best example of the fact that Mayor Adams of New York City is out of touch. He is right in the fact that police don't necessarily know how to deal with mental health issues, but police apparently feel entirely comfortable doing what they do with making the call, which they're legally able to do about forcing involuntary hospitalizations, which is generally not a real great idea. Bonus Article 3, given the heat recently, the heat wave, understanding the effects of heat on mental health. So yet another effect of heat. Anybody who's been irritable when it's been really hot will know the basics of that, but particularly for people with more severe mental health issues, it can arise, a lot of complications can arise. Bonus Article 4, Saharan dust plume arrives in Houston, another health risk as temperatures approach 100. So this was produced in the was published in the Houston Chronicle. That's why it mentions Houston. But actually, the Saharan dust plume arrives in southeast U.S. and other places, depending on the winds. So this is actually a regular thing. Of course, breathing in dust is not good for your health. But it's another reminder of how much the world is connected. And with climate change, the Saharan dust plume is going to get larger because there's a desertification of the existing Saharan desert there. So more dust coming halfway around the world to affect us. Bonus article 5, takeaways from Associated Press's examination of nuclear waste problem in the St. Louis region. Long story short, there is a lot of nuclear uranium enrichment that was done in the St. Louis region, basically because of World War II and the development of nuclear weapons. That's still an ongoing problem. We are still, from a public health perspective, still fighting World War II. And for the latest war, bonus article 6, the U.S. will send depleted uranium munitions to Ukraine. Depleted uranium is not good for you. It gets blown up and turns into dust, and we don't need radioactive dust floating around the world any more than necessary. Of course, they consider that necessary. Bonus article 7. Decades after the dangers of lead became clear, some cities are leaving lead pipe in the ground. So, my regular reporting, I talked about, you know, getting that out of childcare centers and such where kids are have a lot of exposure to lead, and we're trying to get rid of lead pipes. But in a lot of places around the country, when cities dig up pipes for other reasons necessarily, they have the opportunity, since most of the cost is digging it up and reburying it, to replace lead pipes, and are not doing that. So we need to get our act together and do that more diligently. Bonus article 8, why tires, not tailpipes, are spewing more pollution from your cars and brakes too. So this is a follow-up to the story that I had in my regular reporting. So tires and brakes are spewing a lot of pollution. Bonus article 9, EU to drop ban of hazardous chemicals after industry pressure. This is a massive failure. A promise that was made a couple years ago with the big Green New Deal. They're talking about reducing that. It looks like they'll probably reduce it by 90%. Yikes. Bonus article 10, Johnson & Johnson sues researchers who linked talc to cancer. Now I'm telling you, if you make an $8.9 billion settlement and have the ability to deal with that in court, if you have any real way of not linking it to cancer, you had your chance. This is just bullying by a huge corporation to scientists. Bonus article 11, nonprofit hospitals reap big tax breaks, states scrutinize their required charity spending. So I've reported a lot, and this is a good article talking about how nonprofit hospitals get these huge tax breaks and don't necessarily provide much community benefit. But the new reporting here is that states are really starting to push back. If you want to learn how that is, this is a great read. Bonus article 12, who employs your doctor? Increasingly, a private equity firm. Yes, the continued capitalization of people, doctors. Bonus article 13, why nearly half of Americans with Parkinson's don't see a neurologist. Just another canary in the coal mine of how our healthcare system doesn't work well. Bonus article 14, unlocking Ohio's economic potential. The impact of limiting racial disparities on Ohio businesses, governments, and communities. Long story short, you could, by getting rid of these disparities, you could increase the output of our economy by about 10%. Bonus article 15, melanoma, an even more deadly disease in black men. So black men are less likely to get melanoma, skin cancer, but they're about 50% more likely to die of it. Bonus article 16, the end of affirmative action will lead to more preventable deaths. This is because you need a lot of high-level professionals coming through the university system in order to deal with public health and medicine. And affirmative action is going to put a dent in that. We're having a hard time doing a good job in the first place. Bonus article 17, will our healthcare workforce ever look like America? Short answer is not in the foreseeable future. We have shifted into reverse. Bonus article 18, why maternal mortality is so hard to measure and why the problem may get worse. So this is one that, you know, has been a big problem. You know, one of the more vulnerable times in life, pregnancy and delivering babies and having young children. And we don't have really standard measures across the board. You know, states do it differently, and we don't have a national data set to really get at what's going on. So, and these problems, unfortunately, are getting worse. Bonus article 19. Drowning is number one killer of children age 1 to 5. U.S. efforts to fix it are lagging. Now, of course, the number one killer of children from 0 to 18 is actually guns. But for 1 to 5, it's drowning. And again, it's a data problem. We don't do good surveillance to really know exactly what the problem is. And if you don't define what the problem is, it's hard to come up with good solutions. Bonus article 20. India demands higher manufacturing standards from small drug makers. So this is in the aftermath of the poisonings that killed some Americans who took cough syrup. And this actually looks like a pretty substantial increase in the manufacturing standards. And just a reminder that our healthcare system is connected to the world as a whole, and India is the largest producer of drugs in the world, legal drugs. Bonus article 21, presenting a sham treatment as personalized increases the placebo effect in a randomized controlled trial. I could do a whole show on this, but this is really fascinating because really what it gets at, the placebo effect is infinitely fascinating. But the fact that what they're actually measuring is that when you do something that's more personalized, when you give more personalized attention, the placebo effect is actually larger and has its own thing. So, in fact, a lot of drug treatment and healthcare may actually be the connection with a human being and feeling valued. There you go. Bonus article 22, kidney stones are rising among children and teens, especially girls. Just one more thing going up. Bonus article 23, is aspartame a carcinogen? I reported on this last week, but I just wanted to reiterate that there's been a lot of confusing reporting on this, and there's really two different things. The WHO said there's enough evidence that really begs the fact that aspartame should be researched as a carcinogen to determine definitively whether it is. Recommendations by myself and others are that if in doubt, you should use the precautionary principle and avoid it. Now, I wouldn't lose any sleep over eating aspartame. If you're going to lose sleep, that lost sleep is going to be more dangerous than the aspartame. But if you're not going to lose sleep, think about getting it out of your diet. Bonus article 24, really fascinating article. Can ChatGPT defend the long-term use of antipsychotics? This is a great thing both about learning about antipsychotics, but also about artificial intelligence in medicine. And basically, it lays it all out where an expert who's actually talking to ChatGPT gets these middle-of-the-road standard things that aren't very good from a critical thinking point of view, and actually looks like it's confused in the end, has to keep apologizing for making mistakes over and over again. 25, how abortion bans will strain an already failing foster system. It looks like abortion bans will probably increase about 10% the number of kids in foster system. And most women who are not allowed to get an abortion that they want, they're denied that, over 90% actually want to keep their kids. But these are also women who are the most vulnerable and minority women who are put out by the foster system at a much greater rate, separated from their children. Bonus article 26, right-wing politicians are stoking renewed moral panic about HIV. So this is about the really effective but relatively expensive drug that brings HIV levels down to undetectable levels and is a great drug for preventing transmission of HIV. But because it has to do with LGBTQ stuff, the right-wing politicians are stoking renewed moral panic. And sort of related to that, 27, green hushing. Why some companies quietly hide their climate pledges. So this is the opposite of green washing, where companies over-promote their climate pledges when in fact they may not be all that green. But green hushing is basically a backlash from all the garbage that they get from right-wingers trolling them when they actually talk about what they're doing as far as being a green company. Bonus article 28. Judge holds Washington State in contempt for not providing services to mentally ill people in jail. So this is a very interesting ruling that basically denying their rights by not providing services to mentally ill in jails. And maybe that'll be a trend, and we'll see that that'll force some of the more resources into the provision of mentally ill folks, and particularly those in jails. Bonus Article 29, mental health respite facilities are filling care gaps in over a dozen states. So this is a good news story. In a dozen states, they have these, they're sort of like mental health beds and breakfasts, which are not necessarily cheap, but they are way less expensive than people with mental health crises going to emergency rooms and hospitals. And again, just reiterates the point that a lot of mental health crises have to do with not having basic needs met and not having good human connections. Bonus Article 30. Chronic insufficient sleep leads to overeating and eating more junk food. There you go. Bonus Article 31. Want to keep your memory sharp? Here's what science recommends, which is basically exercise and eating well. And lastly, but not least, Bonus Article 32. Having a negative view of aging may be hurting your health and shortening your lifespan. Five ways to change your mindset. So this is a little reframing, cognitive behavioral therapy for yourself, and also points out the fact that not every culture considers old people degenerative brains. China, for example, doesn't have that whole thing about, you know, old people forget all the time and stuff. So there's cultural issues that need to push against, and this is a way that you can help improve your mindset about aging. You can connect with each of these articles and any of the articles I've reported in this episode or any previous episode by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.